Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 24th of June 2018. My name is TRB Watson and this time I'm joined by Gareth James. We're now going to talk about finishing the picture at the Finborough Theatre. This is Arthur Miller's final play, written in 2004 and first performed in Chicago, just months before he died. It is, in a way, a companion piece to his earlier play, Arthur the Fall, which was written in 1964, which is an imaginary telling of both his relationship and death of his father, and also his relationship with Marilyn Monroe. Although I have to say, when I saw that play in 1990 at the National Theatre, instead of having an actress who resembled Marilyn Monroe in the Marilyn Monroe-alike part, they had Josette Simon, the very excellent black actress, in the role, and for me, she really reshaped it. I think I'd seen a television adaptation of After the Fall a year or so before, and it's yet another actress doing a bad Marilyn Monroe impression, and it was refreshing. I remember seeing After the Fall to see somebody who didn't resemble Marilyn Monroe at all just delivering a wonderful performance, I thought, and it was something really special. Finishing the Picture deals with the final months of Arthur Miller's relationship with Marilyn Monroe, in a way. It's a kind of picture of him and other people dealing with Marilyn Monroe while they are making the film The Misfits. It has all been sort of fictionalized. Marilyn Monroe becomes Kitty, and other characters take on different names. We have different aspects of people with a relationship with Marilyn. So, for example, we have a producer. He comes from a trucking firm. He has taken over the studio because lots of the studios were being taken over like this in the late 50s, early 60s. And he has spearheaded the buying of the studio and has taken responsibility. And he is just the biggest fan of this wonderful actress, Kitty, our Marilyn analogue. We have the director, who's clearly worked for her before, is very affectionate towards her, but has trouble with her. He knows he can get good work out of her if he can get her, just can get her to work. We have the cinematographer, who is sort of very old-fashioned, very sexist, but sees the magic in the way that Kitty can look. We have her personal assistant, who's, you know, just trying to help her and keep her on an even keel. And then we have her husband and wife team of an acting coach. We mostly see the wife. And they are based on the Strasbergs. Marilyn Monroe learned method acting from Lee Strasberg and perhaps took it a little bit too seriously. And we get some very interesting stuff there when the Lee Strasberg analogue comes onto the scene later in the play. The cast includes Patrick Bailey, Stephen Billington, Jeremy Drakes, Nikki Goldie, Rachel Hanshaw, Oliver Le Sueur, and Tony Redden. It's directed here by Phil Wilmot with a set design by Isabella von Brakel. It is a fictionalised account of perhaps The Misfits, which is Marilyn Monroe's final finished film. Obviously, there was Something's Got to Give, which is the unfinished film that she did. And it is also the time when she has basically broken up with Arthur Miller. I believe she had a rather public affair with a co-star, Yves Montand, from an earlier film. And that's one of the things that led to the breakup of her marriage with Arthur Miller, although it's quite possible that Arthur Miller was not entirely innocent himself. Miller puts himself into this play as the writer, but the person we don't see is Kitty, the Marilyn analogue ourselves. What happens is that in the first half of the play, we have all of them discussing it. She clearly needs to go into rehab. They need to finish filming. If they can get just enough days out of her to finish the film, then the film will be okay, but they can't get anything out of her at the moment. What they really need, perhaps, is for her to go into rehab, get herself off the drugs and the booze. And then in the second half, we get a rather curious scene where people are sitting outside or standing outside her hotel room, or they're in the hotel room with her. We never see Kitty in this play. And they are trying to talk to her and get her to get up and act and get up and do the play. And I think one of the best things about this is the Lee Strasberg analogue, who is played by, I think, Tony Redden, who comes in and is this incredibly evasive character. He's clearly been one of the factors that has mucked her up and is trying not to take responsibility for it, and is basically knows what power he has over her and knows what influence he has over her, but is trying to deny that he has any. And it's a wonderfully evasive performance, I thought. But I think most of the acting here is very good. I think it's a really fascinating piece as a play, and very lucky to see it. I'd love to see all Arthur Miller, because I'm a big fan of Arthur Miller. I think he might be the only major playwright I've met properly. Well, not properly, I just asked him for his autograph. I really like his plays, and I really, really would like to see things like After the Fall again, you know, just to constantly watch his plays, because even if they don't work, and some of them don't work, he is a really fascinating figure and a really fascinating character. And yeah, unfortunately, he always struggled from being, although he is this leading playwright to us theatre people, he is perhaps best known to everybody else as Mr. Marilyn Monroe, or one of the Mr. Marilyn Monroes. What did you think about this, Gareth?
I mean, I always think it's sad when at the end of a career a playwright produces inferior material, and it's happened a lot, I think. And in Arthur Miller's case, I mean, his last great play was, for me, was Broken Glass in 1994. And then he produced three plays after that, two of which we have already seen. Mr. Peter's Connections of the Almeida, and then Resurrection Blues, which was the worst of the two, at the Old Vic. But we hadn't seen this until the Finnburgh put it on. So it has actually taken 13 years to get across the Atlantic. You know, which when you consider what a figure Miller is in world theatre, that's a bit of a surprise. And what's the other surprise is that it's actually much better than the other two. Actually, the surprise is that it's actually not a bad play at all. It's kind of done a lot to me to sort of redeem the latter part of his career. And I think whatever Miller did say, he insisted that this was a work of fiction. But there is, you know, absolutely no question in my mind here that he's kind of exorcising a period in his life that was still troubling him. I mean, he did it soon afterwards, with After the Fall in 1964, I think it was. That was very hot off the press in that sense. But here we are, right at the end of his life, 40-odd years later, and he's doing it again. And when you see the play and you see his character in the play, you can see why it might still be troubling him, because I think there may be, you know, there may have been guilt there that was kind of still hanging on, and he wanted to kind of get that out. So whatever his protestations, you know, it's hard not to see this play as based on real life experience, and as you say, on the filming of the Misfits. He says they're archetypes, and yes, I mean, the characters are archetypes. You know, the director, Derek Clemson, you know, is an archetypal, very successful director, desperate to complete his film. The cinematographer, Terry Case, is very anxious that she looks right in his shots. And then this new producer, the company's new owners have put in the money man, just wants to make sure it's finished before it's closed down. And then when these two people, one you haven't mentioned, the assistant Edna and the coach Flora, who is the sort of Strasberg character's wife, you know, they're there to sort of keep her together. And I thought that both Flora and Jerome, the Strasberg character, were also archetypes as well as coaches and mentors and teachers. And then you've got this character of the screenwriter who is, you know, called Paul, who, you know, frankly, in the acting here, Jeremy Drakes actually looks like Miller. By putting on a pair of glasses, he looks like Miller and has that very restrained kind of performance there, which I really, really liked. I thought it was excellent. So yes, they are in a way archetypes, but I think, you know, the situation, you know, what happens to the characters is, to me, and, you know, uncannily like what we know about what happened during the Misfits. And I think the most striking thing about the play is, as you say, we don't see Kitty. We don't see this character. And then we have this extraordinary third act when each of the characters in turn, and some more than once, are talking to Kitty through this doorway, which is something very original, I think. I mean, I've never seen a play where you have an unseen character, but dialogue from all of the other characters with the unseen character. I think that's a strikingly original way of doing it. So I thought it's the best of the final plays. It's not a great play, but absolutely well worth seeing. I mean, I, you know, would have been hugely disappointed if life had gone without us ever seeing it here. So, I mean, I think, you know, a great credit to the Finbury Theatre and to Phil Wilmot for actually putting it on. I mean, they've had two other successes with Miller plays in recent years in the same space, with The American Clock and with Incident of Vichy. And on this occasion as well, the combination of staging and design in this really little space and exceptionally good performances really does deliver something, you know, to be very proud of. Not just Isabella van Breckel, the set designer, but actually I thought Penogar's costumes, Rachel Sampley's lighting, and Nicola Chang's sound, because the sound, without saying too much, the sound is actually quite important, particularly in the last act of the play. And I thought that the combination of those four design inputs was outstanding. And in the performances, I thought Oliver Le Sueur, who plays this producer, just kind of somehow created this completely believable sort of rookie producer in Philip. And Philip does have a relationship with Edna. And I thought that the actress who played Edna was also exceptional. That's Rachel Hanshaw. I thought all of the performances were really very good, but I would sort of pick those two out, I think, as well as Jeremy Drakes, who does the kind of Miller character Paul. So I was really, really, I mean, I convened a meeting of the Arthur Miller fan club, which is me and my friend Jan, to go and see it, and I was really, really pleased by it. I thought it was, and I thought it was a really, really fascinating play, and not just for Miller fans, because I think anybody would find an interesting night in the theatre, really. And of that final trio, unquestionably, this is the best of them. So a big recommendation, and I think in particular, congratulations, you know, to the Finbar Theatre. You know, what on earth will we do without them?
We're now going to talk about Machinal at the Almeida Theatre. This is Sophie Treadwell's 1928 play, which tells the story of a young woman over nine scenes. It is directed here by Natalie Abrahami and a set design by Miriam Berta, more of which later and rantier. It stars Emily Barrington with Natalie Armin, Khalil Best, Denise Black, Dimitri Goritas, Andrew Lewis, Jonathan Livingston, John Mackay, Alan Morrissey, Kirsty Ryder, Augustina Seymour, and Dwayne Walcott. What we have here is a young woman who is working in a typing pool. She has caught the eye of the boss in the typing pool. We're in the 1920s. This was not an unknown thing in films at the time, and also in plays where, you know, the young woman from the typing pool catches the eye of the boss. But obviously Sophie Treadwell is taking it further and examining it further in her nine scenes of this play. The young woman is clearly unhappy at home. She enters this marriage. She's not particularly happy in her marriage. In fact, she's fairly dead. And then one night, going out with a girlfriend, she meets a young man and they begin a passionate affair. And we build towards a tragic conclusion. I found this play rather reminiscent of Eugene O'Neill's play The Hairy Ape, which uses the same kind of expressionistic idea, and the scenes has a very, very different feel to it, and almost that expressionistic way that we see in The Hairy Ape. And also it's something about the journey plays you see in a lot of European theatre, where somebody gets knocked off kilter and they go through a strange journey, and each scene is very distinct from the previous one. Although you've got a through line of plot, each one has a slightly different feel. It's not necessarily that they're doing a different structure, although in this play, one of the things they have done is each scene advances by about a decade in terms of costuming and design. The costumes here is by Alex Loud, and he has created the idea of us going into a sort of a different decade each time. I think the final scene we see is kind of in the 1980s. And of course, you don't notice it at the start, because the 20s through to the 40s, there's a lot of similarity between the costumes. But then suddenly, as it goes through, you're seeing more and more changes and more differences between the scenes and the way people dress. And I thought that worked particularly well. I do have to say, I bought a cheap ticket. I was not told that it was a restricted view, but I had a massively restricted view. Normally, the stage at the Almeida is open, and you can always see all areas of the stage. But Miriam Berta, in her wisdom, has decided that she would have a sort of false proscenium arch put in, at least blocking off the sides of the stage, so that she can have this very end-on look. She's using mirrors to identify it, and it meant that there were times that if you were in the bottom left of the back of the stage, on the left of the stage, I would not be able to see anything at all, I simply couldn't see anything. And there were scenes where there's at least one scene set in a restaurant where there seemed to be a very interesting conversation going on, some kind of seduction of one man seducing another man, and possibly he's older and possibly, you know, the one man's younger and the other man's older. I wouldn't have been able to tell because I never actually saw those people at all, just weren't there. And it's extremely disappointing. And this coloured my picture of this play because I was so angry. It really was extremely bad. It just was completely unnecessary. And really, set designers need to sit in all the seats to look at their design, and directors need to sit in all the seats and look at the design. And clearly, they haven't done this. You know, they haven't done this for the cheap seats. Okay, it was only £10. And if somebody had said it's a £10 seat and it's restricted view, I wouldn't be complaining. But I did actually go back and check. There is nothing about it. And you're going to be sold a pup if you're sitting on one of the side seats. You're going to have a restricted view. And you can blame the director and the designer for this. And it is extremely annoying. And it has coloured my view of this play, because the bits of it I saw, I thought, were very interesting and completely fascinating. I like this idea. I mean, having seen the Hairy Ape a couple of times and being reminded very strongly of this, I thought this was a fascinating play and a really, you know, an insight into the kind of the expressionism that American playwrights were using and experimenting with in the 20s and 30s. And I really would have enjoyed it an awful lot if I could have seen it. I mean, the bits of it I could see were very good acting, and really, it was very well put together, and people were trying their hardest. But as I say, I did have a rather bad view. What did you think about it, Gareth?
Well, we'd seen this play before, 25 years ago at the National Theatre, when Stephen Daldry and his designer Ian McNeil did a stunning production of this in the Littleton Theatre. So I kind of knew what I was getting. What I hadn't kind of realised then that I do understand now is that this expressionist movement in the 20s in America was really quite extensive. And of course, you mention Eugene O'Neill's Hairy Ape, which she must have seen because it was 6 years before this. But also we had his other expressionistic masterpiece, Emperor Jones, which was 1920. So she is likely to have seen this as well. So I suspect Sophie Treadwell was influenced by others in the expressionist movement, and in particular by Eugene O'Neill. But her play is based on a real case, a real life story. And one of the sort of interesting little things you find out when you're reading about something is that this actually was Clark Gable's Broadway debut, performing in this, not in a lead role, because obviously the lead role is a woman, but this was his Broadway debut. I mean, it's got a feminist aesthetic and also a focus on mental health, which actually makes it quite up to date, really, apart from the situations and the costumes. Because in the 10 scenes over the 90 minutes or so, this protagonist, who I don't think is ever named, called Young Woman, she's doing what society expects of her. She's doing an office job she doesn't really like, or indeed doesn't do particularly well. She marries the boss, who actually repels her, really. She has a child that she struggles to bond with. And I think what Treadwell is sort of saying is that women are forced to do what society expects of them. And then her twist here is to then propel towards this tragic conclusion, really. Each of the scenes in this particular production start by the parting of screens. So in between the scenes, there are screens that come down from the top and up from the bottom, and they part. And when they part, they reveal this set, which is mirrored diagonally. So you've got a 45-degree angle, I guess, mirror at the back, which I thought was quite striking. And there's also a very mechanical soundscape by Ben and Max Ringham. And I also thought Jack Noel's lighting was very striking. So again, I thought all of the design components, notwithstanding the sightlines, went together to create a good image of this. The scene changes are a bit slow, but I still thought it was quite an immersive experience. And I did, you know, admire all the stagecraft. And probably admired that at the expense of engaging emotionally with the story that much. I did feel as if I was kind of watching a piece of art rather than somebody's story. That said, Elizabeth Barrington, who I'm seeing every Thursday regularly at the moment in Humans on Channel 4, which I like, is hugely impressive in the lead role. She starts off in fear of just about everything, and then she kind of grows in confidence. Two things later in the play, who you wouldn't expect of her based on her performance at the beginning of the play. And Jonathan Livingstone, who's her boss and becomes her husband, to me, I mean, I thought it was a great performance because he just seemed of the period. I mean, everything, all his behaviour seemed completely of the period. And there's a, you know, very good supporting cast. I would pick out Denise Black, who plays her mother, who I thought was great. Trevor apparently wrote, you know, a lot more plays, and she tended to have very diverse themes and very diverse styles. But this is about the only play that has survived, and the only play, certainly, I think we've ever seen in London, because she found it very hard to get her work produced. And a lot of her plays not only have not been performed, but they actually are also unpublished as well, really. So I think she felt neglected in the man's world, and I think that that's, you know, again, a timely thing. And I'd really like to see more of her plays, but I suspect that would be a tough call. But I was glad I went to see it again. I'm not sure, although obviously 25-year gap in memory is difficult, I'm not sure it had the impact on me that it had 25 years ago. And of course, the scale of the Armada is a lot less than the scale of the Littleton. But I was certainly glad I went to see it again, and there were things I liked about it. Your point about silence, I didn't have the same point because I was sitting still at the side, but not too much at the side. But I do understand your point because I've been at the Armada before in a similar situation. And most recently, of course, I had, at a full price ticket, I had the Mike Bartlett Wild experience at Hampstead Theatre, where the play was completely ruined because of the design, where just on the side of the stalls, which is a full price seat, you missed the point, really. So I do understand the point you make. Anyway, I luckily had a better experience than you did, and I would recommend it to people, I think.
We're now going to talk about Leave-Taking at the Bush Theatre. This is Winston Pinnock's 1984 play, which she hasn't done an awful lot since about 2005. I think she lectures at the university these days, but we haven't seen a play from her since 2005. But she used to be a fairly regular fixture on the stage in London. The play here stars Gerard Ho, Nicole Cherry, Will Johnson, Serafina Bey, and Sarah Niles. It's directed by Madani Yunis with a design by Rosanna Vise. It is about a woman who has come over here from Jamaica. We're set in the early 80s or the mid 80s. A woman who came over here as probably a part of the Windrush generation or slightly later. And she is considering going back to Jamaica, and she is struggling with her two young daughters who are British rather than Jamaican, and she's having to deal with that. And she visits a Caribbean soul healer who helps people out with advice and with healing, and she becomes a little bit more involved in this woman's life and her children's lives and indeed her friends' lives. Gareth, tell me more about this play and what you thought of it.
Well, this is somewhat astonishingly the first play by a black woman ever staged at the National Theatre, and that was 30 years ago. And I think it's fascinating that just recently, it's just finished now, but it's transferring to the West End. Nine Night is another play by a black woman that's playing at the National Theatre and the same space in the now Dorfman, then Cottesloe. And I do think there are similarities between the plays in that they're exploring the cultural traditions and the transfers over, you know, from the Caribbean to the UK. And that, for me, makes this play quite timeless, because we've had a lot of talk about the Windrush generation, and that's what this is really about in recent months, and because of the anniversary. And I think that, therefore, the play has absolutely found its time again, because this is exploring the immigrant experience from that generation, but also for the generation that followed. In other words, their children that were born here. So Enid is part of this generation. Her daughters, Del and Viv, were born here, and they're very different daughters. Del is a fairly rebellious one. She's the elder of the two, and Viv is very much the good girl. Enid's a single mum. She's left her abusive husband, and, you know, she holds down a couple of jobs to keep her family together. And her values and her behaviour are very old school. You know, she's very thankful, very respectful. And I thought this was an absolutely gorgeous performance from Sarah Niles, because she put into it all the sort of dignity that the character has, really. I thought it was terrific. There is another character, Uncle Broad. He isn't an uncle, but he pops in on a regular basis and provides a kind of almost a bit of comedy to this. He's a very larger-than-life Caribbean chap. And then we have these visits to this Obeya woman, I think Obeya is the term they use, called Mai, who's this Caribbean healer, and she reads palms, and she reads cards, and she gives baths, and she gives potions. So Enid is a believer in what she does, and she goes there and takes her children there. Her elder daughter, Del, is very much a disbeliever, and then her younger daughter, Viv, is kind of on the fence, really. She's sort of uncommitted about it. And when Enid's mum dies, you know, she's full of guilt. She yearns to go back. Enid's mum is still in the Caribbean. Again, parallel with Nine Night. And she gets more involved with Mai. And then something happens at this point that is a bit unexplained for me, because her daughter gets pregnant and leaves home and ends up lodging with Mai. And I couldn't kind of, you know, understand, well, how did that come about then? And Mai passes on her knowledge and skills to her. And Viv, who wants to take a gap year, she actually walks out of her first A-level, yet still manages to get her university place. So those were the two unexplained bits for me, really. But what you've got here is an older generation that are sort of torn between their adopted homes and their homelands. You know, they've been deeply hurt by the racism they encountered when they came here, but they're hanging on to their sort of heritage and culture. And this next generation are, you know, young British girls. Del, the eldest one in particular, sees no connection with her heritage. Viv is interested and would quite like to explore it. So the play examines that, but it also examines the relationships between the mother and the two daughters, and indeed between the two daughters themselves. So I thought it was a lovely play, and I hadn't seen the original production 30 years ago. So I found it quite enthralling. It's often very funny, largely because of this character abroad, but it's often also very, very deeply moving. And in addition to this lovely performance by Sarah Niles, we've got two young actors, Serafina Bay, who plays this kind of more brittle, unpredictable, older, angry daughter. And then we've got Nicole Cherry, who's a much more caring, much more loyal younger daughter. And I thought they were lovely performances. And then we've got Joando playing something unlike anything we've seen her play before. And the last thing I saw her play was in Julius Caesar, who's got great presence in this healer, Mai. And she's got her own story to tell as well. And she has a place, obviously, in their story too. And then Will Johnson, who plays this character, who's more than a comic character, but it's, you know, he does excel at the very physical comedy. This larger-than-life Broad, who obviously likes a drink. And there's a bit of ambiguity about his relationship with the rest of them. I thought there were lots of parallels with Nine Night. And as I did with Nine Night, I felt that the people of shared heritage around me were clearly going to get more out of it than I did, which is great and fair enough. And they certainly did. But that didn't stop me from admiring both the play and the performances, and considering it another fine evening, you know, of drama, really. In a way, I think it'd be really interesting to also to take this in to the West End and do the two in rep, because I think they kind of belong together in so many ways. But they're different plays, obviously written 30 years apart. But I think they do have similar themes and look at similar situations in a different way. And I think they're really nice companion pieces, to be honest. So I very much enjoyed my evening, and I do hope it has a life beyond the bush, because I think it deserves it.
Yes, I thought this was a very impressive piece. She's a playwright that's always lived in my mind when seeing the plays that I've seen of hers. I hadn't seen this one before, but, you know, I've seen one or two others, and she's always been a very impressive playwright. I'm always very glad to see a Gerard her in anything, and again, the second good performance or great performance of the year for me, but as you say, Sarah Niles is very good in this, and, you know, it's a very, in fact, all of them, you know, all five of them are exceptionally good in this play. It really does take you back to the ideas of where we were, where we've got to. And as you said, it's the idea of a companion piece with Nine Night. I think you said that is the first play by a black woman to have gone into the West End. So in the way that Leave-Taking is the first at the National, I think Nine Night is the first one, it's the first play to be taken by a black woman to be taken into the West End. So we have these couple of firsts 30 years apart, and they really shouldn't have taken that long. But yes, it's almost as if you're seeing the grandparents of the people. Nine Night is really the next generation on. on from leave-taking, because, of course, it's when these young women perhaps grows up to be the daughter in Nine Night. And it shows you that there is this ongoing, it's a little bit difficult to say problems, but it is, you know, a question of identity, certainly within the Jamaican community, which is, I think, what they're talking about mainly here, but also and in the wider West Indian community, the question of identity, the question of are you really British, or should you owe an awful lot to your West Indian heritage? And I think that it's a question that it's useful to talk about and investigate and, you know, think about. Yes, and as you said, the people around you, the West Indian people around you, me, recognised quite a lot more. It's not quite as much in dialect as Nine Night, so it was quite a lot easier to follow some of the parts and get a lot of the inferences and the jokes. In some ways, a much more English play, this one, than Nine Night, which is really going into the vernacular and the argot of Jamaicans. And it was really good to see this play on, and she's a playwright. I think Winston Pinnock is a playwright. I think should be seen more. She's a very interesting playwright, and it would be good to see more of her plays performed and revived like this, and especially with such good revival as this.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.